this afternoon. That is all for today. There is nothing you have to do until she gets here. I will take the next hour to finish my work, and then I will pick her up and bring her back. The weather forecast predicts overcast skies all day. You can spend time in the well while it is still light out without hurting your eyes. As Nutmeg had said, I had no trouble understanding the words that his fingers conveyed. I was unacquainted with sign language, but it was easy for me to follow his complex, fluid movements. It may have been Cinnamon's skill that brought his meaning out so naturally, just as a play performed in a foreign language can still be moving. Or then again, perhaps it only seemed to me that I was watching his fingers move, but was not actually doing so. The moving fingers were perhaps no more than a decorative facade, and I was half-consciously watching some other aspect of the building behind it. I would try to catch sight of the boundary between the facade and the background whenever we chatted across the breakfast table, but I could never quite manage to discern it, as if any line that might have marked the border between the two kept moving and changing its shape. After our short conversations, or communications, Cinnamon would take his suit jacket off, put it on a hanger, tuck his tie inside the front of his shirt, and then do the cleaning or cooking. As he worked, he would listen to music on a compact stereo. One week he would listen to nothing but Rossini's sacred music, and another week Vivaldi's concertos for wind instruments, repeating them so often that I ended up memorizing the melodies. Cinnamon worked with marvelous dexterity and no wasted motion. I used to offer to lend him a hand at first, but he would only smile and shake his head. Watching how he went about his chores, I became convinced that things would progress far more smoothly if I left everything to him. It became my habit after that to avoid getting in his way. I would read a book on the fitting room sofa while he was doing his morning chores. The residence was not a big house, and it had minimal furnishings. No one actually lived there, so it never got particularly dirty or untidy. Still, every day Cinnamon would vacuum every inch of the place, dust the furniture and shelves, clean the window panes, wax the table, wipe the light fixtures, and put everything in the house back where it belonged. He would arrange the dishes in the china cabinet and line up the pots according to size, align the edges of the linen and towels, point all coffee cup handles in the same direction, reposition the bar of soap on the bathroom sink, and change the towels even if they showed no sign of having been used. Then he would gather the rubbish into a single bag, close it up, and take it out. He would adjust the time on the clocks according to his watch, which I would have been willing to bet was no more than 3 seconds out. If in the course of his cleaning he found anything the slightest bit out of place, he would put it back where it belonged with precise and elegant movements. I might test him by shifting a clock half an inch to the left on its shelf, and the next morning he would be sure to move it half an inch back to the right. In none of this behavior did Cinnamon give the impression of obsessiveness. He seemed to be doing only what was natural and right. Perhaps in Cinnamon's mind there was a vivid imprint of the way this world, or at least this one little world here, was supposed to be, and for him to keep it that way was as natural as breathing. Perhaps he saw himself as lending just the slightest hand when things were driven by an intense inner desire to return to their original forms. Cinnamon prepared food, stored it in the refrigerator, and indicated to me what I ought to have for lunch. I thanked him. He then stood before the mirror, straightened his tie, inspected his shirt, and slipped into his suit coat. Finally, with a smile, he moved his lips to say goodbye, took one last look around, and went out through the front door. Sitting behind the wheel of the Mercedes-Benz, he slipped a classical tape into the deck, pressed the remote control button to open the front gate, and drove away, tracing back over the same arc he had made when he arrived. Once the car had passed through, the gate closed. I watched through a crack in the blind, holding a cup of coffee as before. The birds were no longer as noisy as they had been when Cinnamon arrived. I could see where the low clouds had been broken up and carried off by the wind, but above them was yet another, thicker layer of cloud. I sat at the kitchen table, putting my cup down and surveying the room upon which Cinnamon's hands had imposed such a beautiful sense of order. It looked like a large, three-dimensional still life, disturbed only by the quiet ticking of the clock. The clock's hands showed 10:20. Looking at the chair that Cinnamon had occupied earlier, I asked myself once again whether I had done the right thing by not telling them about Ushikawa's visit the night before. Might it not impair whatever sense of trust there might be between Cinnamon and me, or Nutmeg and me? I preferred, though, to wait for a while to see how things would develop. What was it about my activities here that disturbed Noboru Wataya so? Which of his tails was I stepping on, and what kind of countermeasures would he adopt? If I could find the answers to these questions, I might be able to draw a little closer to his secret, and as a result I might be able to draw closer to where Kumiko was. As the hands of the clock were coming up to 11, the clock that Cinnamon had slid half an inch to the right back to its proper place, I went out to the yard to climb down into the well.
I told Cinnamon the story of the submarine in the zoo when he was little, about what I had seen from the deck of the transport ship in August 1945, and how the Japanese soldiers shot the animals in my father's zoo at the same time as an American submarine was training its cannon on us and preparing to sink our ship. I had kept that story to myself for a very long time and never told it to anyone. I had wandered in silence through the gloomy labyrinth that spread out between illusion and truth. When Cinnamon was born, though, it occurred to me that he was the one I could tell my story to, and so, even before he could understand words, I began telling it to him over and over again in a near whisper, telling him everything I could remember, and as I spoke, the scenes would come alive to me in vivid colors, as if I had prized off a lid and let them out. As he began to understand language, Cinnamon asked me to tell him the story again and again. I must have told it to him 100, 200, 500 times, but not just repeating the same thing every time. Whenever I told it to him, Cinnamon would ask me to tell him some other little story contained in the main story. He wanted to know about a different branch of the same tree. I would follow the branch he asked for and tell him that part of the story. And so the story grew and grew. In this way, the two of us went on to create our own interlocking system of myths. Do you see what I mean? We would get carried away telling each other the story every day. We would talk for hours about the names of the animals in the zoo, about the sheen of their fur or the color of their eyes, about the different smells that hung in the air, about the names and faces of the individual soldiers, about their birth and childhood, about their rifles and the weight of their ammunition, about the fears they felt and their thirst, about the shapes of the clouds floating in the sky. I could see all the colors and shapes with perfect clarity as I told the story to Cinnamon, and I was able to put what I saw into words, the exact words I needed, and convey them all to him. There was no end to it. There were always more details that could be filled in, and the story kept growing deeper and deeper and bigger and bigger.
Nutmeg smiled as she spoke of those days long ago. I had never seen such a natural smile on her face before.
"But then, one day it ended," she said. Cinnamon stopped sharing stories with me that February morning when he stopped talking.
Nutmeg paused to light a cigarette.
I know now what happened. His words were lost in the labyrinth, swallowed up by the world of the stories. Something that came out of those stories snatched his tongue away, and a few years later the same thing killed my husband.
The wind grew stronger than it had been in the morning, sending one heavy gray cloud after another on a course due east. The clouds looked like silent travelers headed for the edge of the earth. In the bare branches of the trees in the yard, the wind would give a short, wordless moan now and then. I stood by the well, looking up at the sky. Kumiko was probably somewhere looking at the clouds, too. The thought crossed my mind for no reason. It was just a feeling I had. I climbed down the ladder to the bottom of the well and pulled the rope to close the lid. After taking two or three deep breaths, I gripped the bat and gently lowered myself to a sitting position in the darkness. The total
darkness. Yes, that was the most important thing. This unsullied darkness held the key. It was like a TV cooking program.
Everybody got that now? The secret to this recipe is total darkness. Make sure you use the thickest kind you can buy.
And the strongest bat you can lay your hands on, I added, smiling for a moment in the darkness. I could feel a certain warmth in the mark on my cheek. It told me that I was drawing a little closer to the core of things. I closed my eyes. Still echoing in my ears were the strains of the music that Cinnamon had been listening to repeatedly as he worked that morning. It was Bach's musical offering, still there in my head, like the lingering murmur of a crowd in a high-ceilinged auditorium. Silence descended and began to burrow its way into the folds of my brain, one after another, like an insect laying eggs. I opened my eyes, then closed them again. The darknesses inside and out began to blend, and I began to move outside of myself, the container that held me, as always.
15. This could be the end of the line. Mei Kasahara's point of view, 3.
Hi again, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. Last time I got as far as telling you about how I'm working in this wig factory in the mountains far away with a lot of local girls. This is the continuation of that letter. Lately, it's really been bothering me that, I don't know, the way people work like this every day from morning to night, it's kind of weird. Hasn't it ever struck you as strange? I mean, all I do here is do the work that my bosses tell me to do the way they tell me to do it. I don't have to think at all. It's like I just put my brain in a locker before I start work and pick it up on the way home. I spend 7 hours a day at a workbench, planting hairs into wig bases, then I eat dinner in the cafeteria, take a bath, and of course I have to sleep like everybody else, so out of a 24-hour day, the amount of free time I have is nothing. And because I'm so tired from work, the free time I have, I mostly spend lying around in a fog. I don't have any time to sit and think about anything. Of course, I don't have to work at weekends, but then I have to catch up on the laundry and cleaning, and sometimes I go into town, and before I know it, the weekend is over. I once made up my mind to keep a diary, but I had nothing to write, so I gave up after a week. I mean, I just do the same thing over and over again, day in, day out. But still, it does not bother me at all that I'm now just a part of the work I do. I don't feel the least bit alienated from my life. If anything, I sometimes feel that by concentrating on my work like this, with all the mindless determination of an ant, I'm getting closer to the real me. I don't know how to put it, but it's as if by not thinking about myself, I can get closer to the core of myself. That's what I mean by kind of weird. I'm giving this job everything I've got. Not to boast, but I've even been named Worker of the Month. I told you I may not look it, but I'm really good at handiwork. We divide up into teams when we work, and any team I join improves its figures. I do things like helping the slower girls when I'm finished with my part of a job. So now I'm popular with the other girls. Can you believe it? Me? Popular? Anyway, what I wanted to tell you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, is that all I've been doing since I came to this factory is work, work, work. Like an ant, like the village blacksmith. Have I made myself clear so far? Anyway, the place where I do my work is really weird. It's huge, like a hangar, with a great high roof and wide open. 150 girls sit lined up working there. It's quite a sight. Of course, they didn't have to put up such a monster factory. It's not as if we're building submarines or anything. They could have divided us up into separate rooms, but maybe they figured it would increase our sense of communal solidarity to have that many people working together in one place. Or maybe it's just easier for the bosses to oversee the whole bunch of us at once. I'll bet they're using whatchamacallit psychology on us. We're divided up into teams, surrounding workbenches just like the ones in science class where you dissect frogs, and one of the older girls sits at the end as team leader. It's okay to talk, as long as you keep your hands moving. I mean, you can't just shut up and do this stuff all day long. but if you talk or laugh too loud or get too engrossed in your conversation, the team leader will come over to you with a frown and say, "All right, Yumiko, let's keep the hands moving, not the mouth. Looks like you're falling behind." So we all whisper to each other like burglars in the night. They pipe music into the factory. The style changes depending on the time of day. If you're a big fan of Barry Manilow or Air Supply, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, you might like this place. It takes me a few days to make one of my wigs. The time differs according to the grade of the product, of course, but you have to measure the time it takes to make a wig in days. First, you divide the base into checkerboard squares, and then you plant hair into one square after another in order. It's not assembly line work, though, like the factory in Chaplin's movie, where you tighten one bolt and then the next one comes. Each wig is mine. I almost feel like signing and dating each one when I'm through with it. But I don't, of course. They just get mad at me. It's a really nice feeling to know, though, that someone out there in the world is wearing the wig I made on his head. It gives me a sense of, I don't know, connectedness. Life is so strange, though. If somebody had said to me 3 years ago, 3 years from now, you're going to be in a factory in the mountains making wigs with a lot of country girls, I would have laughed in their face. I could never have imagined this. And as for what I'll be doing 3 years from now, nobody knows the answer to that one either. Do you know what you're going to be doing 3 years from now, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? I'm sure you don't. Forget about 3 years. I'd be willing to bet all the money I've got here that you don't know what you'll be doing a month from now. The girls around me, though, know pretty much where they'll be in 3 years, or at least they think they do. They think they're going to save the money they make here, find the right guy after a few years, and be happily married. The guys these girls are going to marry are mostly farmer sons or guys who will inherit the store from their fathers or guys working in small local companies. Like I said before, there's a chronic shortage of young women here, so they get bought up pretty quickly. It would take some really bad luck for anybody to be left over, so they all find somebody or other to marry. It's really something. And as I said in my last letter, most people leave work when they get married. Their job in the wig factory is just a stage that fills the few years gap between leaving school and getting married. Like a room they come into, stay in a little while, then leave. Not only does the wig company not mind this, they seem to prefer to have the girls work just a few years and leave when they get married. It's a lot better for them to have a constant turnover of workers rather than have to worry about salaries and benefits and unions and stuff like that. The company takes better care of the girls with ability who become team leaders, but the other ordinary girls are just consumer goods to them. There's a tacit understanding then between the girls and the company that they will get married and leave. So for the girls, imagining what is going to happen 3 years from now involves only one of two possibilities. They'll either be looking for a mate while they go on working here, or they will have left to get married. Talk about simplicity! There just isn't anybody around here like me who is thinking to herself, "I don't know what's going to happen to me 3 years from now." They are all good workers. Nobody does a botched job or complains about the work. Now and then, I'll hear somebody griping about the cafeteria food, that's all. Of course, this is work we're talking about, so it can't be fun all the time. You might have somebody putting in her hours from 9 to 5 because she has to, even though she really wants to run off for the day. But for the most part, I think they're enjoying the work. It must be because they know this is a finite period suspended between one world and another. That's why they want to have as much fun as possible while they're here. Ultimately, this is just a transition point for them. Not for me, though. This is no time of suspension or transition for me. I have no idea at all where I'm going from here. For me, this could be the end of the line. Do you see what I mean? So strictly speaking, I am not enjoying the work here. All I'm doing is trying to accept the work in every possible way. When I'm making a wig, I don't think about anything but making that wig. I'm deadly serious, enough so that I break out in a sweat all over. I don't quite know how to put this, but lately I've been thinking about the boy who got killed in the motorcycle accident. To tell you the truth, I haven't thought too much about him before. Maybe the shock of the accident twisted my memory or something in a weird way, because all I remembered about him were these weird kinds of things, like his smelly armpits or what a totally dumb guy he was, or his fingers trying to get into strange places of mine. Every once in a while, though, something not so bad about him comes back to me, especially when my mind is empty and I'm just planting hairs in a wig base. These things come back to me out of nowhere. Oh, yeah, I'll think he was like that. I guess time doesn't flow in order, does it? A, B, C, D. It just sort of goes where it feels like going. Can I be honest with you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? I mean, really, really, really honest? Sometimes I get so scared. I'll wake up in the middle of the night all alone, hundreds of miles away from anybody, and it's pitch dark, and I have no idea what's going to happen to me in the future, and I get so scared I want to scream. Does that happen to you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? When it happens, I try to remind myself that I am connected to others, other things, and other people. I work as hard as I can to list their names in my head. On the list, of course, is you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. And the alley, and the well, and the persimmon tree, and that kind of thing, and the wigs that I've made here with my own hands, and the little bits and pieces I remember about the boy, all these little things, though you're not just another one of those little things, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, but anyhow, help me to come back here little by little. Then I start to feel sorry I never let my boyfriend see me naked or touch me. Back then, I was determined not to let him put his hands on me. Sometimes, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, I think I'd like to stay a virgin the rest of my life. Seriously, what do you think about that? Bye-bye, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. I hope Kumiko comes back soon.
16. The World's Exhaustion and Burdens. The Magic Lamp. The phone rang at 9:30 at night. It rang once, then stopped, and started ringing again. This was to be Ushikawa's signal.
"Hello, Mr. Okada," said Ushikawa's voice. "Ushikawa here. I'm in your neighborhood and thought I might drop by, if it's all right with you. I know it's late, but there's something I wanted to talk to you about in person. What do you say? It has to do with Miss Kumiko, so I thought you might be interested."
I pictured Ushikawa's expression at the other end of the line as I listened to him speaking. He had a self-satisfied smile on his face, lips curled and filthy teeth exposed, as if to say, "I know this is an offer you can't refuse." And, unfortunately, he was right. It took him exactly 10 minutes to reach my house. He wore the same clothes he'd had on 3 days earlier. I could have been mistaken about that, but he wore the same kind of suit and shirt and tie, all grimy and wrinkled and baggy. These disgraceful articles of clothing looked as if they had been forced to accept an unfair portion of the world's exhaustion and burdens. If through some kind of reincarnation it were possible to be reborn as Ushikawa's clothing, with a guarantee of rare glory in the next rebirth, I would still not want to do it. After asking my permission, Ushikawa helped himself to a beer in the refrigerator, checking first to see that the bottle felt properly chilled before he poured the contents into a glass he found nearby. We sat at the kitchen table.
"All right, then," said Ushikawa. "In the interest of saving time, I will dispense with the small talk and plunge directly into the business at hand. You would like to talk with Miss Kumiko, wouldn't you, Mr. Okada? Directly. Just the two of you. I believe that is what you've been wanting for some time now. Your first priority. Am I right?"
I gave this some thought, or I paused for a few moments, as if giving it some thought. "Of course, I want to talk with her if that is possible."
"It is not impossible," said Ushikawa softly with a nod.
"But there are conditions attached?"
"There are no conditions attached."
Ushikawa took a sip of his beer.
"I do have a new proposition for you this evening, however. Please listen to what I have to say and give it careful consideration. It is something quite separate from the question of whether or not you talk to Miss Kumiko."
I looked at him without speaking.
"To begin with then, Mr. Okada, you are renting that land and the house on it from a certain company, are you not? The Hanging House, I mean. You are paying a rather large sum for it each month. You have not an ordinary lease, however, but one with an option to buy some years hence, correct? Your contract is not a matter of public record, of course, and so your name does not appear anywhere, which is the point of all the matters. machinations. You are, however, the de facto owner of the property, and the rent you pay accomplishes the same thing as mortgage payments. The total sum you are to pay, let's see, including the house, comes to something in the region of 80 million yen, does it not? At this rate, you should be able to assume ownership of the land and the building in something less than 2 years. That is very impressive. Very fast work. I have to congratulate you.
Ushikawa looked at me for confirmation of everything he had been saying, but I remained silent.
Please don't ask me how I know all these details. You dig hard enough, you find what you want to know, if you know how to dig. And I have a pretty good idea who is behind the dummy company. Now that was a tough one. I had to crawl through a labyrinth for it. It was like looking for a stolen car that's been repainted and had new tires put on and the seats recovered and the serial number filed off the engine. They covered all their traces. They're real pros. But now I have a pretty good idea of what's going on. Probably better than you do, Mr. Okada. I'll bet you don't even know who it is you're paying the money back to, right?
That's all right. Money doesn't come with names attached. Ushikawa laughed.
No, you're absolutely right, Mr. Okada. Money does not come with names attached. Very well said. I'll have to write that down. But, Mr. Okada, things don't always go the way you want them to. Take the boys at the tax office, for example. They're not very bright. They only know how to squeeze taxes out of places that have names attached, so they go out of their way to stick names on where there aren't any, and not just names, but numbers too. They might as well be robots for all the emotion that's involved in the process, but that is exactly what this capitalist society of ours is built on, which leads us to the conclusion that the money you and I are now talking about does indeed have a name attached, and a very excellent name it is.
I looked at Ushikawa's head as he spoke. Depending on the angle, the light created some strange dents in his scalp.
Don't worry,
he said with a laugh.
The taxman won't be coming here, and even if he did come, with this much of a labyrinth to crawl through, he'd be bound to smash into something. Wham! He'd raise a huge bump on his head. And finally, it's just a job for him. He doesn't want to hurt himself doing it. If he can get his money, he'd rather do it the easy way than the hard way. The easier, the better. As long as he gets what he's looking for, the brownie points are the same. Especially if his boss tells him to take the easy way. Any ordinary person is going to choose that. I managed to find what I did because it was me doing the searching. Not to boast or anything, but I'm good. I may not look it, but I'm really good. I know how to avoid injury. I know how to slip down the road at night when it's pitch blackout. But to tell you the truth, Mr. Okada, and I know you're one person I can really open up to, not even I know what you're doing in that place. I do know the people who visit you there are paying an arm and a leg. So, you must be doing something special for them that's worth all that money. That much is as clear as counting crows on snow. But exactly what it is you do and why you're so stuck on that particular piece of land, I have no idea. Those are the two most important points in all this. But they are the very things most hidden, like the center of a palmist signboard. That worries me.
Which is to say, that's what worries Noboru Wataya, I said. Instead of answering, Ushikawa started pulling on the matted fuzz above his ears.
This is just between you and me, Mr. Okada, but I have to confess I really admire you. No flattery intended. This may sound odd, but you're basically a really ordinary guy. Or to put it even more bluntly, there's nothing at all special about you. Sorry about that, but don't take it the wrong way. It's true, though, in terms of how you fit in society. Meeting you face-to-face and talking with you like this, so I'm very, very impressed with you, with how you handle yourself. I mean, look at the way you've managed to shake up a man like Dr. Wataya. That's why I'm just the carrier pigeon. A completely ordinary person couldn't pull this off. That's what I like about you. I'm not making this up. I may be worthless scum, but I don't lie about things like that, and I don't think of you in totally objective terms either. If there's nothing special about you in terms of how you fit in society, I'm 100 times worse. I'm just an uneducated twerp from an awful background. My father was a tatami maker in Funabashi, an alcoholic, a real bastard. I used to wish he'd die and leave me alone. I was such a miserable kid, and I ended up getting my wish for better or worse. Then I went through storybook poverty. I don't have a single pleasant memory from childhood. Never had a kind word from either parent. No wonder I went bad. I managed to squeak through high school, but after that it was the school of hard knocks for me. Lived on my wits, what little I had. That's why I don't like members of the elite or official government types. All right, I hate them. Walk right into society through the front door. Get a pretty wife, self-satisfied bastards. I like guys like you, Mr. Okada, who've done it all on their own.
Ushikawa struck a match and lit another cigarette.
You can't keep it up forever, though. You're going to burn out sooner or later. Everybody does. It's the way people are made. In terms of evolutionary history, it was only yesterday that men learned to walk around on two legs and get in trouble thinking complicated thoughts. So don't worry, you'll burn out. Especially in the world that you're trying to deal with, everybody burns out. There are too many tricky things going on in it. Too many ways of getting into trouble. It's a world made of tricky things. I've been working in that world since the time of Dr. Wataya's uncle, and now the doctor has inherited it lock, stock, and barrel. I used to do risky stuff for a living. If I had kept it up, I'd be in jail now. Or dead. No kidding. The doctor's uncle picked me up in the nick of time. So these little eyes of mine have seen a hell of a lot. Everybody burns out in this world. Amateur, pro, it doesn't matter. They all burn out. They all get hurt. The okay guys and the not okay guys both. That's why everybody takes out a little insurance. I've got some, too, here at the bottom of the heap. That way you can manage to survive if you burn out. If you're all by yourself and don't belong anywhere, you go down once and you're out. Finished. Maybe I shouldn't say this to you, Mr. Okada, but you're ready to go down. It's the sure thing. It says so in my book, in big black letters about 2 or 3 pages ahead. Toru Okada, ready to fall. It's true. I'm not trying to scare you. I'm a whole lot more accurate in this world than weather forecasts on TV. So all I want to tell you is this. There's a time when things are right for pulling out.
Ushikawa closed his mouth at that point and looked at me. Then he went on.
So, let's stop all this sounding each other out, Mr. Okada, and get down to business. Which brings us to the end of a very long introduction. So now, I can make you the offer I came here to make.
Ushikawa put both hands on the table. Then he flicked his tongue over his lips.
So let's say I've just told you that you ought to cut your ties with that land and pull out of the deal. But maybe you can't pull out even if you want to. Maybe you're stuck until you pay off your loan.
Ushikawa cut himself short and gave me a searching look.
If money's a problem, we've got it to give you. If you need 80 million yen, I can bring you 80 million yen in a nice, neat bundle. That's 8,000, 10,000 yen bills. You can pay off whatever you owe and pocket the rest, free and clear. Then it's party time! Hey, what do you say?
So then the land and building will belong to Noboru Wataya? Is that the idea?
Yes. I guess that's the way things work. I suppose there are a lot of annoying details that will have to be taken care of, though.
I gave his proposal some thought. You know, Ushikawa, I really don't get it. I don't see why Noboru Wataya is so eager to get me away from that property. What does he plan to do with it once he owns it? Ushikawa slowly rubbed one cheek with the palm of his hand.
Sorry, Mr. Okada, I don't know about things like that. As I mentioned to you at first, I'm just a stupid carrier pigeon. My master tells me what to do when I do it, and most of the jobs he gives me are unpleasant. When I used to read the story of Aladdin, I'd always sympathize with the genie, the way they worked him so hard. But I never dreamed I'd grow up to be like him. It's a sad story, let me tell you. But in the end, everything I have said to you is a message I was sent to deliver. It comes from Dr. Wataya. The choice is up to you. So, what do you say? What kind of answer should I carry back?
I said nothing.
Of course you will need time to think. That is fine. We can give you time. I don't mean you to decide right now, on the spot. I would like to say take all the time you want, but I'm afraid we can't be that flexible. Now let me just say this, Mr. Okada. Let me give you my own personal opinion. A nice, fat offer like this is not going to sit on the table forever. You could look away for a second, and it might be gone when you look back. It could evaporate like mist on a window pane. So please, give it some serious thought. In a hurry. I mean, it's not a bad offer. Do you see what I mean?
Ushikawa sighed and looked at his watch.
Oh, my. I've got to be going. Overstayed my welcome again, I'm afraid. Enjoyed another beer. And as usual, I did all the talking. Sorry about that. I'm not trying to make excuses, but I don't know. When I come here, I just seem to settle in. You have a comfortable house here, Mr. Okada. That must be it.
Ushikawa stood up and carried his glass and beer bottle and ashtray to the kitchen sink.
I'll be in touch with you soon, Mr. Okada, and I'll make arrangements for you to talk with Miss Kumiko, that I promise. You can look forward to it soon.
After Ushikawa left, I opened the windows and let the accumulated cigarette smoke out. Then I drank a glass of water. Sitting on the sofa, I cuddled the cat, Mackerel, on my lap. I imagined Ushikawa removing his disguise when he was one step beyond my door and flying back to Noboru Wataya. It was a stupid thing to imagine. XVII. The Fitting Room. A Successor. Nutmeg knew nothing about the women who came to her. None of them offered information about herself, and Nutmeg never asked. The names with which they made their appointments were obviously made up, but around them lingered that special smell produced by the combination of power and money. The women themselves never made a show of it, but Nutmeg could tell from the style and fit of their clothes that they came from backgrounds of privilege. She rented space in an office building in Akasaka, an inconspicuous building in an inconspicuous place, out of respect for her client's extreme concern for their privacy. After careful consideration, she decided to make it a fashion design studio. She had, in fact, been a fashion designer, and no one would have found it suspicious for substantial numbers of a variety of women to be coming to see her. Her clients were all in their 30s to 50s. Nutmeg stocked the room with clothing and design sketches and fashion magazines, brought in the tools and workbenches and mannequins needed for fashion design, and even went so far as to design a few outfits to give the place an air of authenticity. The smaller of the two rooms she designated as the fitting room. Her clients would be shown to this fitting room, and on the sofa they would be fitted by Nutmeg. Her client list was compiled by the wife of the owner of a major department store. The woman had chosen a strictly limited number of trustworthy candidates from among her wide circle of friends, convinced that in order to avoid any possibility of scandal, she would have to make this a club with an exclusive membership. Otherwise, news of the arrangement would be sure to spread quickly. The women, chosen to become members, were warned never to reveal anything about their fitting to outsiders. Not only were they women of great discretion, but they knew that if they broke their promise, they would be permanently expelled from the club. Each client would telephone to make an appointment for a fitting and show up at the designated time, knowing that she need not fear encountering any other client and that her privacy would be guaranteed. Honoraria were paid on the spot in cash, their size having been determined by the department store owner's wife, at a level much higher than Nutmeg would have imagined, though this never became an obstacle. Any woman who had been fitted by Nutmeg always called for another appointment, without exception. "You don't have to let the money be a burden to you," the department store's owner's wife explained to Nutmeg. "The more they pay, the more assured these women feel." Nutmeg would go to her office 3 days a week and do one fitting a day. That was her limit. Cinnamon became his mother's assistant when he turned 16. By then it had become difficult for Nutmeg to handle all the clerical tasks herself, but she had been reluctant to hire a complete stranger. When, after much deliberation, she asked her son to help her with her work, he agreed immediately, without even asking what kind of work it was she did. He would go to the office each morning at 10 o'clock by cab, unable to bear being with others on buses or tube trains, clean and dust, put everything where it belonged, fill the vases with fresh flowers, make coffee, do whatever shopping was needed, put classical music on the cassette player at low volume, and keep the books. Before long, Cinnamon had made himself an indispensable presence in the office. Whether clients were due that day or not, he would put on a suit and tie and take up his position at the waiting room desk. None of the clients complained about his not speaking. It never caused them any inconvenience, and if anything, they preferred it that way. He was the one who took their calls when they made appointments. They would state their preferred time and date, and he would knock on the desktop in response, once for no and twice for yes. The women liked this conciseness. He was a young man of such classic features that he could have been turned into a sculpture and displayed in a museum, and unlike so many other handsome young men, he never undercut his image when he opened his mouth. The women would talk to him on their way in and out, and he would respond with a smile and a nod. These conversations relaxed them, relieving the tensions they had brought with them from the outer world and reducing the awkwardness they felt after their fittings. Nor did Cinnamon himself, who ordinarily disliked contact with strangers, appear to find it painful to interact with the women. At 18, Cinnamon got his driving license. Nutmeg found a kindly driving instructor to give him private lessons, but Cinnamon himself had already been through every available instruction book and absorbed the details. All he needed was the practical know-how that couldn't be obtained from books, and this he mastered in a few days at the wheel. Once he had his license, he pored over the used car books and bought himself a Porsche Carrera, using as a down payment all the money he had saved working for his mother, none of which he ever had to use for living expenses. He made the engine shine, bought new parts through mail order, put new tires on, and generally brought the car's condition to racing level. All he ever did with it, though, was drive it over the same short, jam-packed route every day from his home in Hiro to the office in Akasaka, rarely exceeding 40 miles an hour. This made it one of the rarer Porsche 911s in the world. Nutmeg continued her work for more than 7 years, during which time she lost 3 clients. The first was killed in a car accident, the second suffered permanent expulsion for a minor infraction, and the third went far away in connection with her husband's work. These were replaced by 4 new clients, all the same sort of fascinating middle-aged women who wore expensive clothing and used aliases. The work itself did not change during the 7 years. She went on fitting her clients, and Cinnamon went on cleaning the office, keeping the books and driving the Porsche. There was no progress, no retrogression, only the gradual aging of everyone involved. Nutmeg was nearing 50, and Cinnamon turned 20. Cinnamon seemed to enjoy his work, but Nutmeg was gradually overcome by a sense of powerlessness. Over the years, she went on fitting the something that each of her clients carried within. She never fully understood what it was that she did for them, but she continued to do her best. The somethings, meanwhile, were never cured. She could never make them go away. All that her curative powers could do was reduce their activity somewhat for a time. Within a few days, usually from 3 to 10 days, each something would start up again, advancing and retreating over the short span, but growing unmistakably larger over time, like cancer cells. Nutmeg could feel them growing in her hands. They would tell her, "You're wasting your time. No matter what you do, we are going to win in the end." And they were right. She had no hope of victory. All she could do was retard their progress to give her clients a few days of peace. Nutmeg would often ask herself, "Is it not just these women? Do all the women of the world carry this kind of something inside them? And why are the ones who come here all middle-aged women? Do I have a something inside me as well?" But Nutmeg did not really want to know the answers to her questions. All she could be sure of was that circumstances had somehow conspired to confine her to her fitting room. People needed her, and as long as they went on needing her, she could not get out. Sometimes her sense of powerlessness would be deep and terrible, and she would feel like an empty shell. She was being worn down, disappearing into a dark nothingness. At times like this, she would open herself to her quiet son, and Cinnamon would nod as he listened intently to his mother's words. He never said anything, but speaking to him like this enabled her to attain an odd kind of peace. She was not entirely alone, she felt, and not entirely powerless. How strange, she thought. I heal others, and Cinnamon heals me. But who heals Cinnamon? Is he like a black hole, absorbing all pain and loneliness by himself? One time, and only that once, she tried to search inside him by placing her hand on his forehead, the way she did to her clients when she was fitting them. But she could feel nothing. Before long, Nutmeg felt that she wanted to leave her work.
"I don't have much strength left. If I keep this up, I will burn out completely. I'll have nothing left at all."
But people continued to have an intense need for her fitting. She could not bring herself to abandon her clients just to suit her own convenience. Nutmeg found a successor during the summer of that year. The moment she saw the mark on the cheek of the young man who was sitting in front of a building in Shinjuku, she knew. 18. A Stupid Tree Frog Daughter. Mei Kasahara's Point of View, 4.
Hi again, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. It's 2:30 in the morning. All my neighbors are sound asleep, but I can't sleep tonight, so I'm up writing this letter to you. To tell you the truth, sleepless nights are as unusual for me as sumo wrestlers who look good in berets. Usually, I just slip right into sleep when the time comes and slip right out when it's time to wake up. I do have an alarm clock, but I almost never use it. Every rare once in a while, though, this happens. I wake up in the middle of the night and can't get back to sleep. I'm planning to stay at my desk writing this letter to you until I get sleepy, so I don't know if this is going to be a long letter or a short one. Of course, I never really know that any time I write to you until I get to the end. Anyway, it seems to me that the way most people go on living, I suppose there are a few exceptions, they think that the world or life or whatever is this place where everything is, or is supposed to be, basically logical and consistent. Talking with my neighbors here often makes me think that, like when something happens, whether it's a big event that affects the whole of society or something small and personal, people talk about it like, oh, well, of course that happened because such and such. And most of the time people will agree and say, oh, sure, I see. But I just don't get it. A is like this, so that's why B happened. I mean, that doesn't explain anything. It's like when you put instant rice pudding mix in a bowl in the microwave and push the button, and you take the cover off when it rings, and there you've got rice pudding. I mean, what happens in between the time when you push the switch and when the microwave rings? You can't tell what's going on under the cover. Maybe the instant rice pudding first turns into macaroni cheese in the darkness when nobody's looking, and only then turns back into rice pudding. We think it's natural to get rice pudding after we put rice pudding mix in the microwave and the bell rings, but to me that's just a presumption. I would be kind of relieved if every once in a while, after you put rice pudding mix in the microwave and it rang, and you opened the top, you got macaroni cheese. I suppose I'd be shocked, of course, but I don't know. I think I'd be kind of relieved, too, or at least I think I wouldn't be so upset because that would feel in some way a whole lot more real. Why more real? Trying to explain that logically in words would be very, very, very hard. But maybe if you take the path my life has followed as an example and really think about it, you can see that it has had almost nothing about it that you could call consistency. First of all, it's an absolute mystery how a daughter like me could have been born to two parents as boring as tree frogs. I know it's a little weird for me to be saying this, but I'm a lot more serious than the two of them combined. I'm not boasting or anything. It's just a fact. I don't mean to say that I'm any better than they are, but I am a more serious human being. If you met them, you'd know what I mean, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. Those people believe that the world is as consistent and explainable as the floor plan of a new house in a high-priced development. So if you do everything in a logical, consistent way, everything will turn out right in the end. That's why they get upset and sad and angry when I'm not like that. Why was I born into this world as the child of such absolute dummies? And why didn't I turn into the same kind of stupid tree frog daughter, even though I was raised by those people? I've been wondering and wondering about that ever since I can remember, but I can't explain it. It seems to me there ought to be a good reason, but it's a reason that I can't find. And there are tons of other things that don't have logical explanations. For example, why does everybody hate me? I didn't do anything wrong. I was just living my life in the usual way. But then all of a sudden, one day, I noticed that nobody liked me. I don't understand it. So then one disconnected thing led to another disconnected thing, and that's how all kinds of stuff happened. Like, I met the boy with the motorcycle, and we had that stupid accident, the way I remember it, or the way those things are all lined up in my head. There's no, this happened this way, so naturally that happened that way. Every time the bell rings, and I take off the cover, I seem to find something I've never seen before. I don't have any idea what's happening to me. And before I know it, I'm not going to school anymore, and I'm hanging around the house, and that's when I meet you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. No, before that I'm doing surveys for a wig company. But why a wig company? That's another mystery. I can't remember. Maybe I hit my head in the accident, and the position of my brain got messed up. Or maybe the psychological shock of it started me covering up all kinds of memories, the way a squirrel hides a nut and forgets where he's buried it. Have you ever seen that happen, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? I have. When I was little, I thought the stupid squirrel was so funny. It never occurred to me the same thing was going to happen to me. So anyhow, I started doing surveys for the wig company, and that's what gave me this fondness for wigs, like they were my destiny or something. Talk about no connection. Why wigs and not stockings or rice scoops? If it had been stockings or rice scoops, I wouldn't be working hard in a wig factory like this, right? And if I hadn't caused that stupid bike accident, I probably wouldn't have met you in the back alley that summer. And if you hadn't met me, you probably would never have known about the Miyawaki's well. So you wouldn't have got that mark on your face, and you wouldn't have got mixed up in all those strange things. Probably. When I think about it like this, I can't help asking myself, where is there any logical consistency in the world? I don't know. Maybe the world has two different kinds of people. And for one kind, the world is this logical rice pudding place. And for the other, it's all hit-or-miss macaroni cheese. I bet if those tree frog parents of mine put rice pudding mix in the microwave and got macaroni cheese when the bell rang, they'd just tell themselves, oh, we must have put in macaroni cheese mix by mistake. Or they'd take out the macaroni cheese and try to convince themselves, this looks like macaroni cheese, but actually, it's rice pudding. And if I tried to be nice and explain to them that sometimes, when you put in rice pudding mix, you get macaroni cheese, they would never believe me. They'd probably just get mad. Do you understand what I'm trying to tell you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird? Remember when I kissed your mark that time? I've been thinking about that ever since I said goodbye to you last summer, thinking about it over and over, like a cat watching the rainfall, and wondering, what was that all about? I don't think I can explain it to myself, to tell you the truth. Sometime way in the future, maybe 10 years or 20 years from now, if we have a chance to talk about it, and if I'm more grown up and a lot cleverer than I am now, I might be able to tell you what it meant. Right now, though, I'm sorry to say, I think I just don't have the ability, or the brains, to put it into the right words. One thing I can tell you honestly, though, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, is that I like you better without the mark on your face. No, wait a minute, that's not fair. You didn't put the mark there on purpose. Maybe I should say that even without your mark, you're good enough for me. Is that it? No, that doesn't explain anything. Here's what I think, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. That mark is maybe going to give you something important, but it also must be robbing you of something, kind of like a trade-off. And if everybody keeps taking stuff from you like that, you're going to be worn away until there's nothing left of you. So, I don't know. I guess what I really want to say is that it wouldn't make any difference to me if you didn't have that thing. Sometimes I think that the reason I'm sitting here making wigs like this every day is because I kissed your mark that time. It's because I did that I made up my mind to leave that place, to get as far away as I could from you. I know I might be hurting you by saying this, but I think it's true. Still, though, it's because of that I was finally able to find the place where I belong. So in a sense, I am grateful to you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. I don't suppose it's much fun to have somebody be, in a sense, grateful to you, though, is it? So now I feel like I've said just about everything I have to say to you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. It's almost 4 o'clock in the morning. I have to get up at 7:30, so maybe I'll be able to sleep 3 hours and a little bit. I hope I can get to sleep right away. Anyhow, I'm going to end this letter here. Goodbye, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. Please say a little prayer so I can get to sleep.
XIX. The Subterranean Labyrinth. Cinnamon's Two Doors.
There's a computer in that house, isn't there, Mr. Okada? I don't know who's using it, though,
said Ushikawa. It was 9 o'clock at night, and I was sitting at the kitchen table with the phone to my ear. There is, I said, and left it at that. Ushikawa made a sniffling sound.
I know that much from my usual snooping,
he said.
Of course, I'm not saying anything one way or another about the fact that you've got a computer there. Nowadays, anybody doing any kind of brain work has to have a computer. There's nothing weird about it. To cut a long story short, though, the idea hit me that it might be good if I could contact you through the computer. So I looked into it. But damn, it's a hell of a lot more complicated than I imagined. Just calling up on an ordinary phone line wouldn't make the connection. Plus, you need a special password for access. No password and the door doesn't budge. That did it for me.
I kept silent.
Now, don't get me wrong, Mr. Okada. I'm not trying to crawl inside your computer and fool around in there. I don't have anything like that in mind. With all the security you've got in place, I couldn't pull data out even if I wanted to. No, that was never an issue. All I have in mind is trying to set up a conversation between you and Miss Kumiko. I promised you I'd do that, remember? That I'd do what I could to help you and her talk to each other directly. quickly. It's been a long time since you left your house, and it's a bad idea to leave things hanging like this. The way it stands now, your life is probably just going to get weirder and weirder. It's always best for people to talk to each other face to face, to open themselves up. Otherwise, misunderstandings are bound to arise, and misunderstandings make people unhappy. Anyhow, that's how I tried to appeal to Miss Kumiko. I did everything I could, but I just couldn't get her to agree. She insisted that she wouldn't talk to you directly, not even on the phone, since a face-to-face meeting was out of the question. Not even on the phone! I was ready to give up. I tried every trick in the book, but her mind was made up, like a rock.
Ushikawa paused for me to react, but I said nothing.
Still, I couldn't just take her at her word and back.